Okay, today I'm in Warwickshire with Andrew Michael. Thank you very much, Andrew, for agreeing to talk to us today. You're a financial and horse racing journalist and editor. It's a very unusual combination. First of all, can you tell us why you love horse racing?
Well, on this sort of marquee day, thanks for making the one large step for mankind for coming up to Warwickshire to say hello, Simon. You're right, I'm a financial journalist and editor kind of through and through, and I also cover horse racing, which I think makes me slightly unusual, if not unique, in the kind of UK press. But I think there are some parallels there and stuff that, you know, certainly there's definitely some overlap. I love horse racing. I think it probably goes back to that kind of, you know, what sort of family you were brought up in. Did you, you know, some families are very non-gambling, non-horsey, non-equine. Mine were non-equine, but my mum and dad were restaurateurs in the 1950s, and my dad was quite a recreational, but quite a shrewd horse racing punter, I think. And he used to like to also do the football pools. In fact, they launched their restaurant. They had a restaurant on the south coast of England. And he launched that business on the back of a pools win in 1950. And the great thing about Dad was he even back then, he loved to study the form. And I think that has rubbed off on yours truly. So studying the form, he'd be poring over probably the Daily Express in those days, and Peter O'Sullivan was probably the racing correspondent. And even through the 50s and 60s, when I came along, he used to take the Racing and Football Outlook, which was quite a specialist trade paper for someone like him to be reading back then. But I think that kind of interest in studying over and above just the horses' names or whatever was kind of probably what got me into horse racing as well. Solving this great puzzle, this challenge of trying to find winners, taking in as much data as possible. It's probably why I ended up in the career as a financial journalist as well. From a very early age, Dad was, probably had that effect on me. I remember, you know, they were a very busy pair, my mum and dad, through the 50s and 60s. But I remember when I came along in the very late 60s, that my first race course visit was to Y Races, which, there you go, marks out how old I am. Because I think it closed in 1975 or thereabouts. I remember him shutting up the shop one day and saying, right, we're going racing. I was intrigued by the spectacle even then. I remember it was a very sunny day, and I just remember the horses running past, you know, the furlong pole or whatever it was, and thinking, well, this is jolly interesting for a small child to be doing. And very occasionally, we'd also go to Dumpton Park Greyhounds, the supremely named Dumpton Park Greyhounds. And again, one would just look at the action going on, and just the idea of, you know, those gentlemen, often mainly gentlemen, bookmakers, you know, giving out these betting slips. I was intrigued by those old card betting slips, and then occasionally punters going back and redeeming these betting slips for cash. It all seemed very interesting to me. I come back from a time when if Dad, you know, used to sneak out for a quick bet, you know, in between service, he might take me down to the betting shop, you know, in where we used to live. And of course, you know, for betting shop, we might as well have read sex shop, mightn't we? In the way we had those ribboned doorways and under 18s weren't allowed in, but you'd peer through, and Dad would come out with replete with pencils and betting slips. And I think this is jolly good. He goes in with nothing. He comes out with pencils and betting slips to give me to draw on. So I thought the whole thing from an early age was very interesting, notwithstanding things like the jockeys' names. I mean, Lester Piggott is a very... It's quite a rare name, isn't it, even nowadays? I mean, when you think that footballers in the early 70s were maybe called Alan Clark, Lester Piggott, Frankie Durr, Edward Hyde, Cock of the North, you used to look in the paper and see those kind of jockey names. You'd see the names of the horse races themselves. The Cherry Hinton, the Cesarewitch. This whole kind of a picture built up, which I just found absolutely fascinating. So that's kind of probably thanks to Dad. My mother, bless her, who died 3 years ago, was not a bad punter in her own rights either. Her favourite horse by a country mile was Big Orange, who was kind of in his pomp a few years ago, about the time, just not long before she died. And in fact, she loved that horse so much that at her funeral, my sister and I, amongst all the other Reeves that turned up for Mum, we also put one together in the yellow, black and white racing colours, because Mum was so fond of that horse. So... I don't know. I come from a family who weren't averse to. They were recreational gamblers. They're not. They weren't hardcore gamblers, but they certainly knew one end of a page of betting form than others might.
So you're in love. I've read you. Well, you've told me that you're in love with gambling, pitting your wits against other people. You know, it's like you think it's an instructive sort of pastime. So what do you bet on?
Well, I think as a journalist, I think it's quite interesting to have a view. And if you're taking a view, you're maybe formulating an opinion, factoring all sorts of elements of information. So, and I think it's very interesting. I think it's very important actually as a financial journalist, and some others in my kind of cohort might disagree with me, but I think it's very important that journalists or financial journalists can price up things. So one of my big heroes is the way Sir Thomas Cromwell in the books Wolf Hall by Hilary Mantel has been portrayed as a pricer upper of stuff. I think being able to price up the probability of a certain event, whether it's the next leader of the Conservative Party and our Prime Minister to be, or the Eurovision Song Contest winner for 2020, or indeed the winner of the Cesarewitch. I think it's very important to be able to kind of put together some kind of sense of what the likelihood of outcomes are. So I'm quite a numerate person. Dad died when I was 13, but I went to university and read physics at university. So I'm quite numerate. And in my second year, actually, as an undergraduate, I lived in Ascot, which was quite a eye-opening event for an undergraduate student on a grant. So I'm inclined. I'm not quite into the mode of betting on two flies chasing up a wall. But if you, I certainly would have an opinion on a football match, a political outcome, the next Booker Prize winner, etc. And indeed, of course, we might talk about this a bit more. You know, stock market prospects, the prospects for individual companies, and so on.
Now you're too modest to mention it so far, but you are actually a multiple award-winning financial journalist. Could you just give us a brief background of who you've written for and what you've won?
Sure. Well, I came into journalism in 1988, and that's quite important because this is very much a pre-internet, pre-social media time. I'm very much of the old school of, I was lucky to have an electric typewriter to work with in my first job as a reporter. I'm a phoner-upper of people. I'm familiar with typesetters and deadlines and old school hackery, if you like. I come from that end of the spectrum, and I don't think that's a bad thing because there was so little information very often in even the financial space that I covered, and indeed later on in when I moved into writing about racing, you had to compile your own data, and I think that is a really good discipline for a journalist who's not working the general news beat, but who is maybe writing about a specific area of finance, specific part of horse racing, to really understand what's going on. Do your own survey work, do your own research, do your own data crunching. It's probably a bit, if I dare say, the Racing Post is perhaps lacking a bit, or the racing press, shall we say, is a bit lacking in nowadays. And obviously there are reasons why, it's a resource-driven thing. And through the 80s and 90s, when I was doing my stuff, there was resource to do quite a lot of data crunching. So I feel very lucky that I come from that pre-internet age. I worked at the Financial Times Group for 10 years between 1990 and 1999. Started off as a reporter and then did all manner of different news editing and features editing roles. Then got my first editor's job, and I'd always set my sights on being an editor by the time I was 30, and I'd done that. I was an editor in a magazine when I was 28, and then I was also given free rein by the FT to go and launch magazines as well. So I have a kind of a slight, although I'm a journalist, if you cut me in half and see what it says journalist, but I am sympathetic to the kind of commercial side of publishing, and indeed the way businesses need to be commercial to turn a buck.
Okay. Sorry, carry on.
Sorry, so I'm talking about my big specialist areas, really, are pensions and investments. And these are topics that aren't to everyone's interest. But actually, once you scratch past the P word of pensions, You know, the you look at when I was writing about pensions in the 1990s, I started a magazine because I realised there were about 800, 900 billion pounds worth of funds invested in the UK pensions market. You know, enormous sums of money, but no one was really covering this week in, week out. And it doesn't take a genius to work out that if an industry is taking maybe 1% of 900 billion pounds a year, you know, you've got quite a big sort of ecosystem at work there. Stakeholders within that system. Yet no one was really holding financial companies to rights, the pension funds to rights, and so on. So through the 90s, I won various awards for investment writing, won various awards for writing about pensions, and indeed for venture capital. So reasonably well stocked up on writing about finance. My contacts book grew exponentially through the 90s. And also I might say at the same time, writing about finance, you often used to come across quite a few interesting financial racing people whose day job was finance, and that was an interesting sort of string to one's bow, because if you were having a bit of a hard time trying to chase down X to talk about derivatives or whatever, you could maybe ask them what their views were on the upcoming Royal Hunt Cup, and they'd suddenly start talking to you. So in fact, in a way, there is this, wherever you are, there is this kind of overlap between racing and finance, if you sort of dig deeply enough.
So can you tell us how, it's both gambling, I'm assuming, but how similar or dissimilar are the financial and horse racing markets?
Well, I think the older I get, there are differences, but there is some overlapping, I think, and perhaps some of my peers in the financial press probably a bit more strongly anti-gambling mentality than someone like myself. I would say that there are plenty of disappointments to be had in the financial world. I mean, at the moment we have a very big issue with a chap called Neil Woodford and his very large multi-billion pound fund being closed, not allowing his customers effectively to withdraw their money from that fund, which has caused ructions for week on week on week and will continue to do so. I remember reporting on the Maxwell pension when he went over the side of his boat in 1990s, and a lot of people were left high and dry from his pension funds. I remember a very fine and upstanding seemingly life insurance company called Equitable Life going down the Carsey, again leaving a lot of people with very burnt fingers. So actually there are quite a few financial scandals. I think the issue with perhaps consumers of financial products versus consumers of gambling products is there is this expectation that they will always be bailed out if it's in the financial sense. And sometimes consumers probably aren't their own worst enemies and probably invest in things which really were rather, idiotic with retrospect, with the benefit of hindsight. So I think it's incumbent actually on whether you're a consumer of financial products or an investor in the stock market or one who just likes a punt to kind of be wary of where your money is going and the likelihood of you getting it back in the circumstances that you should be winning.
Okay, Andrew, you've mentioned to me when we chat before the interview that you're interested in the business of making money from gambling, which I imagine a lot of people watching this will be as well, whichever method of gambling it is, whether it be stocks and shares or whatever, or horse racing. Can you elaborate on what you mean by that, please?
I can, Simon. I'd also caveat that by saying, if I start off on January the 1st with £100 and do some gambling and at the end of the year end up with £106, that's a winning year. And if you can replicate 6% year on year over 25 years, you're going to come out with a fair sum of money. So what I'm trying to say there is in the financial space, and I think in the probably for your would-be bettors and your would-be gamblers, there is this idea of, you have to kind of work out what kind of gambler you are, what kind of punter you are, where is your risk appetite? Do you want to treble your money in 2 days? Well, best of British luck to you if you can do that, but the chances of you replicating that week in, week out are extremely unlikely. So I would say myself, I'm sort of a slow and steady gambler, and in a way I'm trying to replicate the sorts of returns that I am used to seeing and I know are capable of being achieved in the financial space. So if you look at all the data going back 100 years on, mature stock markets like those in the US and in the UK and so on. Probably net, you know, you're talking about returns of 7-8% a year. And that means we're talking about backing 1-14, you know, 1-12, 1-14 shots. So, and that doesn't appeal to everybody. But, you know, as I say, 7% per annum return compounded over 25 years, and we should all be, you know, pretty happy with that. So, I find it very odd, actually, when people go to the races, even for a recreational or a social day out, you talk to people and they say, well, I've taken £100, I expect to lose it all, or I'll come back, have a lovely day, but, you know, I don't mind if I come back with nothing. Well, actually, I always think, well, do you know what, yeah, why don't you spend a little bit more time in between sips of champagne or pints or whatever, just having a little look at the form, just trying to see if you can eke out, maybe coming back with £60 of your £100 if you're taking, you know, or you know, if you're going to spend £5 a race, try and maybe come back with half the money you took out to be staking it. I think it's the mentality and the psychology of investing and gambling, you know, in some respects they're not so different. But whereas if someone went to a fund manager or to looked at their pension fund and saw big losses year on year in those situations or in their savings accounts, they would go into conniptions. I think it's a different kind of mentality when we're going for a recreational day's punting. And so we just have to just work out where we stand on the risk spectrum and understand that, you know, very, you know, leverage returns are probably not achievable. But, you know, that's each to their own. So I won't necessarily absolutely criticise people for thinking they can turn a fortune overnight, but we kind of know that's not very likely.
Okay, so is that your personal punting? You'd be looking for absolutely nailed on and chisel out a few quid over a year, you know, looking for those big odds uncertainties? Or?
I think so. Coupled with, I mean, I'm quite a fan of what's called core satellite investing. And this is kind of almost 1980s, 1990s concept, whereby you stick a lot of institutional pension funds and big institutional asset managers would stick a lot of money into tracking the index, because a lot of fund managers don't beat the index. We know that. So why would you even employ the services of a fund manager who says that's what they can do, when we know a lot of them can't? So core satellite investing involves kind of betting the index and then also, but taking risk at the margins on slightly more elaborate or slightly more risky markets, maybe emerging markets or stuff like that. And I suspect that's one way of doing things. So you could, you know, that's one way of investing in the stock market. It's just one way. Other people will always look to replicate a market, you know, they'll do their asset allocation differently. But personally, yeah, I think, you know, if I go to the races for a day out now and I start off with X in my pocket and I come back with 50% of X, I think I've had a really lousy day. If I come back with 101% of X, I'm thinking not bad.
So would you bet every day recreationally? No, not recreationally. Would you bet every day to make money? Would you just look for opportunities?
No, I mean, I'm hands on the table. I'm a journalist and I make my crust from writing, you know, and editing and doing that kind of stuff. I thought it was quite a big enough risk when I left the FT in 1999 to become a freelance writer. I used to employ a lot of freelance writers, but never had actually done it myself. So I cut all the cords and went, you know, safety net free to see if I could eke out a crust from writing. And I'm very glad to say I did that. And in fact, it was at about that time, through, you know, the late 90s, early noughties, where people said to me, well, actually, Andrew, you'd write, finance is your bread and butter, but you obviously clearly love your horse racing. Why don't you go down the horse racing route full time? So as luck would have it, and serendipity is often a way in these things, in I think it was 2002-2003, an old acquaintance of mine, James Hipwell, was launching, who many people will know for all and sundry reasons, was launching a sports betting magazine. He was going to be the editor of a sports betting magazine called Inside Edge, published by Dennis Publishing. And he got in touch with me and said, would you fancy being the kind of freelance horse racing editor? And this was music to my ears, and also it meant I could go back to kind of basics, because having been slightly well known in the financial space, I, you know, tried to get hold of a press badge And obviously the racing, the people, that the authorities that issued press badges in those days didn't know me from Adam, didn't care what my backstory was in the financial world. So they said, well, you better get a portfolio of stories together, Sonny, to kind of convince us of your intention. So I did that. And so I had a lovely time working on Inside Edge for 3 or 4 years. And even then, we're talking at a time when, you know, we're talking a monthly magazine with long lead-in times, writing about Cheltenham Festival or Glorious Goodwood or whatever it was. And you know, even back, we're not talking more than what was 15, 16 years ago, the availability of race information and archives of racing videos just did not exist. So I go back to that kind of age-old thing of compiling your own data, the importance of doing that, working through the numbers, trying to spot trends, trying to spot stuff that might give you an edge, and did that for Inside Edge for, you know, a few years, which was great fun.
Now, you talk about Inside Edge, I would have thought one thing that is very similar in both financial investor and horse racing is inside information. Mm. Now, which is the most reliable?
Oh, there's a question. Well, we all know inside information in the financial space is naughty, naughty. And I suspect, actually, in this day and age, compared with even the time when I came into the financial space in the late 80s, it's, you know, there is much less of it goes on. But then at the same time, we know, don't we? It always never ceases to amaze me, actually, that, you know, you talk about great racing gambles and great plots and great coups, kind of perpetrated by racing stables. And what always never ceases to amaze me is that it wouldn't be marvellous if there were two, you know, plots and coups going on at the same time, you know, for the same big race, Sadarovich or something. And you know, only one can win. So even when you think you've actually got a surefire thing going, you know, you can never be totally sure. And I suppose, you know, with my background, my characteristics, I think, are quite good to be a journalist, because I'm quite suspicious and I'm quite cynical, and I can know one end of a set of numbers from another. So I think this kind of feeds into my, you know, just because someone says something is an absolutely surefire winner, is an absolutely surefire winning way to end up, you know, in the gutter financially.
And then tell us a bit more about your Swinley Bottom blog that you did.
Yeah, well, Swinley Bottom, it's interesting. I'm a journalist really through and through. And obviously, through the noughties, the idea of blogging was quite a nascent thing. It has really obviously come on a pace in recent years. And how marvellous is it for people now to self-publish on any subject they desire? But as I say, I lived in Ascot as an undergraduate back in the late 80s, the mid 80s. And I used to run round. Ascot Racecourse was a much more open public space for the public just to wander around outside of race days in those days. And I used to go running round the inside of the racecourse. And I was always intrigued by this part of this race called Swinley Bottom, which I thought would be a jolly good good name for a blog. So I came up with this name, top comment from racing's most famous bottom. And that gives me a kind of an out nowadays to write about whatever I so desire. I'm interested in not just gambling and the horse racing and trying to find winners, which I guess is what Swinley Bottom's about. I'm also very interested in the business of horse racing, how bookmakers make things pay, how race courses make things pay, how they can offer some value to the race going punter. And one thing I would say, because I gave up my press badge a while back, you know, I've always been a supporter of racecourse memberships as well. I stump up, I put my hands in my pocket for Newmarket membership, Cheltenham membership, Warwick membership as well. And know what it's like to go through the gates having paid for a season ticket effectively to the racecourses. So I'm interested in that stuff. I think probably there is a publishing opportunity there in terms of the way different companies come and go with their race course and racing and race sponsorships. I think that's all terribly interesting. I was having a chat with a bookmaker the other day who sponsored the whole card of a race meeting just recently. And I tweeted something, actually, and the guy came back to me and direct messaged me, and we had a little chat, because I was wondering whether this chap, as the boss of this bookmaking firm, was actually getting very good value from the race course, given that he had sponsored the whole seven race card. Because I do think there is perhaps a slight feeling and sense that maybe from the kind of the establishment side of racing, that all of us Johnny come latelys that maybe put up money to sponsor race meetings or sometimes pay to come through the front door, could all be done, if they could all be done aside with, actually that would be just fine by, you know, from the more established ranks within the canon. And we had this kind of to and fro, and he said, well, what do you think that they could have done more for us as a race course better? And I said, well, I think they could have given you much more credit in this race card. I think they could have given you more broadcast credit on the day with, in terms of paddock interviews and so on. And I just, you know, I think the business of racing in all its many guises, not just trying to find the winner of the Stewards' Cup, are very interesting.
Well, Andrew, you said in the previous part that you did sort of suspect that the establishment in the racing industry does look down on us mere mortals, which I think possibly, sadly, is true. But you suspect many in the financial service industry look down on gambling too. So why do you think that is?
Well, I think there are some notable exceptions there, but I think there is just this differentiation between gambling on things like sport and the kind of rather ivory tower notion of making money from the city and from people who work in the city who take our hard-earned money. And it's always worth remembering that if you give someone, you know, your hard-earned £200 a month to invest in an investment fund, it is your money they're investing, not theirs. Although many people in the financial services space, I think sometimes, if they don't forget it, they don't show enough humility that this is the case. And I think that's very important from us as consumers of financial services products. I think the financial services industry very often tries its best to come up with products that do well by us. But there is just, the other thing is, I would just like, and this actually applies to bookmakers as well, Simon, as well as, you know, banks and large financial institutions, sometimes I can't be doing with Barclays and its Digital Eagles, and I can't be doing with Lloyds and its, you know, gambling horses down beaches. I just like Barclays to be a bank and do banky things, so that when I go into the branch in Leamington Spa or wherever, it just does what I want it to do. And ditto with bookmakers. I mean, there isn't. I just like bookmakers to be bookmakers sometimes and not be too overly chummy. I just like them to maybe stand a bet. And pay out on a bet and treat us as though we're, you know, normal human beings. Obviously, there's been a lot of talk just lately about the being knocked back on the Frankie Ackers. But actually, I just wonder, bookmakers have been around long enough. Maybe they could do a bit more to educate the public about what their liabilities are, what it means to be a bookmaker if you are faced with lots of people all wanting the same bet. It's a bit like working in the insurance world. We're all worried about if we take out our car insurance and we have a prang, and then won't we get paid out to the extent that we thought we would do? It's a very sort of one end of the telescope argument. If you understand more about how the insurance world works and how insurance is put together by big companies, they're obviously looking at me as an individual amongst thousands and thousands of individuals. But when I come to claim, my experience is from the other end of the spectrum. So I just think that sometimes, without being too, there's not always a great room for sentiment in financial services, probably not in bookmaking and indeed punting either. But I just think that bookmakers probably could help themselves a bit more just by making it very clear what they do, and maybe working with race courses, making it clear what they do, rather than standing as kind of maybe maybe an aloof band of people on the rails that occasional race goers kind of see, and, you know, a little bit them and us. Maybe a bit more integration, a bit more education wouldn't go amiss on all fronts.
Okay, now you've said you think that UK horse racing is both brilliant and infuriating. That's quite a strong statement.
Yes, it is, isn't it? It is great. And just the variety of British horse racing is absolutely fabulous. I think we have to ask ourselves also the question of, is British horse racing and Irish, but, you know, I talk mainly from the British perspective. Is British racing in rude health? Not sure about that, actually. It It would appear to be when we see the big festivals. It would appear to be when we see the big music events and what have you going on, bolted on to race meetings. I would just spin that around on its head, actually, and say, well, the other weekend, we had the Glastonbury Festival, didn't we? And would Glastonbury goers not have gone to Glastonbury on the Friday of Glastonbury had there been a six race flat racing card at the bottom of one of those fields? And the answer is, of course they wouldn't. They would have gone for the music, end of. Nowadays, a certain cohort of British race goers, I think, are having to kind of go to race meetings and almost feel as though they're the rump end of the customer spectrum, because after racing there's a massive music gig. I think it would be very interesting to find out from somewhere like Newmarket Nights, who have been doing their Friday night music stints for years now. It would be very interesting to know if they think that the customers that go for the music actually then feed back into customers of horse racing going forward. And if they don't, you know, is that then just, are just Newmarket Nights then just there to fill an income gap? Or what is their purpose? I think the sport of horse racing sometimes sells itself very short and forgets what it has got to offer in isolation without having to bring in sort of extracurricular activities, which, while might appeal to a younger race goer, probably alienates other race goers and customers on that overall spectrum.
And the other thing you were talking to me about was race sponsorship. You've got the ump about that a bit.
I having been a publisher and having, although I'm a journalist, I do understand the imperative to make money and the commercials and all that side of the business bridge, if you like. And I think bookmaking down the years has always been probably one step ahead of the sport of horse racing. Which kind of gets my craw a little bit, Simon, if I'm honest. I think race courses are probably sometimes their own worst enemies in terms of the way they have operated with bookmakers. Here's a pot of money from a bookmaker. We'll take that. We'll maybe go down the slightly lazy route of allowing bookmakers to change the name of heritage or of races in the race card. And whereas that might shore up my finances for this year and next year, does it do the long-term sport of horse racing a great deal of good? I'm not sure it does. I just wish that someone would put their foot on the ball in this country and say, actually, chaps, this race is called the Stewards' Cup, and you can call this race the Stewards' Cup, supported by XYZ bookmakers, but that's the race format for that name. Not keep changing and chopping and changing heritage race names for the sake of a bit of sponsorship, which I'm not sure may well be here today, gone tomorrow, and actually doesn't then do the narrative of horse racing any great good in the long run. I have another beef, I'm afraid, slightly about the whole notion of trainers being sponsored by bookmakers, jockeys sponsored by bookmakers, and indeed sort of the whole ambassadorial thing. I have no beef with individual bookmaking firms wanting their pound of flesh in terms of promotion and brand stretching and all the rest of it. That's absolutely fine. That's a given. But being a suspicious old journalist that I am at heart, I always ask myself things. Does this initiative pass the NIF test? And I don't think in the long run these sorts of initiatives do. I can absolutely see why bookmakers do it. I can absolutely see why jockeys and trainers will want to supplement their incomes. But are there cleverer, more innovative ways for race courses and racing as a whole to work with the bookmaking industry to give the bookmakers their pound of exposure, flesh, but do it in slightly more innovative ways? You don't see, for example, do you, race stands? You don't see the Ladbrokes stand at wherever, at a race course. You don't see certain initiatives where maybe a kind of forward-looking race course could say, well, actually, we could do a deal with you, dear bookmaker. We'd love some of your money, but there are other ways we can take your money and give you the brand exposure without necessarily kind of interfering, if you like, with individual jockey's presence and just leaving that little bit of kind of question mark with the racing public which, you know, in the long term, good doesn't necessarily, you know, fulfill a great positive.
Okay, now you talked about bookmakers a bit there. One thing that the financial industry has that the bookmaking industry doesn't is an ombudsman.
Mm.
Now, what, you've got some opinions on that?
I have. I wish there was a gambling ombudsman, Simon. I'm aware of the Gambling Commission, and actually, I had a quick look at their website the other day just to check. It's quite an interesting thing. There is stuff about complaints on the Commission's website, but ostensibly the impact it gives you is very much, would you go gambling with this firm if it was not licensed, kind of feel to their website. Now, I come from the financial space, and I scrutinise the money sections, you know, like a hawk, week in, week out. And one thing that's worked very well for the financial press, I think, is in terms of consumer champions, financial agony aunts and uncles, who do, you know, the job of I got legged over by an insurance company, or someone won't pay out this, or whatever. And I just wonder, actually, if the financial press or the press is missing a bit of a gap here in terms of having more of a champion in this space. I appreciate there are some very good work being done by some individuals, especially on Twitter, taking up the cases and taking up cudgels on behalf of disgruntled punters on certain disputes. At the same time, some of the great financial services consumer champions are not averse to saying, you idiot, why on earth did you expect to get paid out in compensation from this incident? And I'm sure, from the bookmaker's perspective, you can reel off a million instances where consumers aren't always in the right. Consumers are more entitled sometimes than they ought to be in terms of in terms of grievances with bookmakers. And I just think it would be an interesting area to elaborate on. Over time, in the last 20 years, the rise of the financial ombudsman in the financial space for people to go to for dispute resolution, I think, has risen. Ombudsman is a very, you know, kind of Victorian or earlier word, and still a bit threatening to people. But I think more and more people are being educated to go to, if they don't get resolution with a dispute with an insurer direct or a bank direct, they can go to the ombudsman. They have this kind of next line of recourse. Wouldn't it be marvellous if there was a gambling ombudsman that could kind of fill that gap in the betting kind of sphere?
Okay, now you can't get off the hook, really. You're a journalist, financial journalist, and a horse racing journalist. Very briefly, tips for successful investment and punting.
Wow, how many days have you got to answer this? I think the best way to answer the investing thing is, personally, probably one of the most edifying things I've done as a in the financial space is I used to chair an investment club of 20 like-minded souls in a pub, each person very egalitarian, very democratic, each putting in their 20 quid a month, and then meeting once a month in a pub to buy a particular share or stock or whatever security. And over time, you build up quite a sum of money and you give everyone their say. It's very interesting in those situations, quite close to situations where if person X says, well, actually, I was in Sainsbury's last weekend, they seem to be doing okay by me, I think we should buy Sainsbury's stock. And someone else being maybe a bit more kind of analytical, saying, well, actually, I've got the Sainsbury's report and accounts here, and, you know, it's all, you know, I'm not picking on Sainsbury's, I'm just giving an example, but, you know, I don't see where the prospects are coming from. It's very interesting because actually, in the end, very often people aren't necessarily absolutely right and absolutely wrong. But common sense is a very important ingredient, whether you're making stock market decisions or I think betting on the horses or anything else. I would say if you're investing in the stock market and you're interested in reading company reports and accounts, I would always start from the back page of report and accounts and work from back to front, because if anything's going to be buried, it's going to be buried at the back of a report. I think very often it's interesting to tally reports and accounts with what actually a company is doing, what it says it's doing, and what it's actually doing. I mean, I'm a very privileged person. As a journalist, I can pick up a phone to a broker or to an expert or to whatever and get, you know, several experts' views on instant X or potential instant Y. But if we're not just in consumer mode, we can't always do that. But we can. There are so many outlets for information now that we're better served than ever before to kind of keep scrutiny on companies and fund managers and all the rest of it. So I think the best thing to do, a far, far more important person to look at in terms of talking common sense, in terms of his investment patterns and strategies in the last 60 plus years, is someone like Warren Buffett, the sage of Omaha, runs Berkshire Hathaway. He's in his 90s now. You can find out a lot of information about what he does. And actually, he talks a very simple, straightforward, pretty sensible game. So if your audience is interested in stock market investing, I would start with the likes of Warren Buffett.
And punting?
Well, as I say, I think you have to approach punting with the right kind of risk appetite and understand you're not going to make a quick buck. Absolutely not. Or some, for every person that does, there are 10,000 that don't. So I think it's quite interesting. The punts that I like best are ones, the biggest horse racing that I ever had was on Harzand winning the Derby in 2016. And it was only because the clues were there in terms of, I think he'd won the Ballysacks over in Ireland. It was trained by Dermot Weld, owned by the Aga Khan, and yet the price of that horse for you know, from the April through to the Derby in June was very, very elevated. I mean, I think you have to look at, if you get an understanding of where trainers target their horses year in, year out, you know, when they're, you get an understanding of what they think the horses are like. It might give you a chance of kind of latching on to the ride. So Harzand and Pour Moi in the Derby, was it 2013 or whenever? Pour Moi won the Prix Greffoul in France, I think, but was a 12-1 shot in a six-runner race, although it was owned by Magny & Co. So I think, you know, the Prix Greffoul is a kind of a identifiable Derby trial over there. But it struck me at the time that the prices for those horses were far and away above what they probably would be if they rocked up for the Derby. So it was worth having a punt on them. Obviously, one couldn't be sure until the day, and I think the rains came in time for Harzand. But I think that was factored into the price. So I'm afraid, folks, there's no escape for kind of getting used to pricing stuff up, getting a kind of a feel for the more granular stuff, I think, knowing your form, doing a bit of data crunching. It can't hurt, can it?
Brilliant. Andrew Michael. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Look out for our regular money-back offers, including Pipped in the Post on selected horse racing and Saved by the 90s for all Premier League and televised championship matches. BeGambleAware.org. Over 18 only.